Iran's foreign minister says Washington needs to show initiative and flexibility for the sanctions removal talks to proceed successfully. Russia preparing to launch the battle for Donetsk as Ukrainian forces take up defensive positions. Also ahead, Mexico's president calls for a campaign to dismantle the Statue of Liberty if Julian Assange is extradited to the U.S. and convicted. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mnis. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it is ready to once again engage constructively in the talks for the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action to achieve an agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says that Tehran backs a strong and lasting agreement. Amir Abdollahian says, however, that this would hinge on the U.S. showing initiative and flexibility. He made the comments in a phone talk with his Omani counterpart, Badr al-Busaidi. The Omani official said that his country supports the realization of the legitimate demands of Iran in the talks. Iran and the U.S. held indirect talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, last week. Tehran says the main hurdle to an agreement in the discussions remains the U.S. committing itself to its obligations under the JCPOA. Iran's president says the sky is the limit when it comes to the enhancement of ties with Baku, stressing that this can lead to effective regional cooperation. In a meeting with the visiting Azeri foreign minister, Ebrahim Raisi also called for more public travels between the two countries. He said greater interaction between the people of the two countries will also consolidate friendly ties between the nations. Shehun Bayramov, for his part, said the bilateral trade volume has increased considerably over the past 17 months. He also echoed Iran's long-standing position that regional issues should be resolved by the countries in the region without foreign interference. Bayramov also met with his Iranian counterpart earlier in the day. Hossein Amir Abdollahian called for a peaceful resolution of the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh region, declaring Iran's readiness to help. Russia has slammed as unacceptable the recent strikes on Syria that have been blamed on Israel, calling for an unconditional cessation of the attacks. The Russian Foreign Ministry has strongly condemned the attacks as irresponsible actions that violate Syria's sovereignty. Moscow says such aggressions also constitute a breach of international law. On the 2nd of July, Israel carried out fresh airstrikes on the Arab country. Damascus said that Israel fired several missiles from the Mediterranean, west of the Lebanese city of Tripoli, targeting Syria's port city of Tartus. According to Syrian officials, at least two civilians were injured in the attack. The strike also caused some material damage. That was the latest in the spate of Israeli strikes against Syria. Damascus has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and has filed official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. Peter Ford is a former UK ambassador to Syria who joins us from Manchester. Peter Ford, welcome. Taking a look at the reaction coming from Russia, we have had just recently reactions from Russia, but this one is more stern. It is more to the point and issuing, in a sense, a warning to Israel. Do you see it that way, and why do you think Russia is coming out more forcefully at this point?
Well, it's important to look at the geography here. The target of the Israeli strike was close to the town of Tartus, which is important for Russia. Tartus is a port. Russia uses that port to provide assistance to Syria. And there are Russian forces there at the invitation of the Syrian government who must have been close to the site of the attack. So it's not surprising that Russia should feel concerned and concerned that Israel should have the arrogance to strike in broad daylight as well, which is unusual. To strike in broad daylight at a target in the vicinity of Russian asset. I think Russia felt obliged to respond in those circumstances. And this latest attack comes just about 2 weeks after a large-scale Israel's airport, which paralyzed that international airport for a couple of weeks. Russia responded on that occasion, and now we see a form of Israeli escalation.
So based on what you have said, this then would be a calculated attack from Israel on that port city of Tartus, given that there are Russian assets there. What kind of message is Israel trying to send Russia by this attack?
Well, we can only speculate, but it's possible that Israel is signaling, look, Russia, we can see that you are very busy in Ukraine. Therefore, we think that we Israelis have more freedom in Syria. You have been acting as a brake on our attacks. We have had to be a little bit restrained, but now we know that you are tied down in Ukraine. And by the way, we are on the other side. We, the Israelis, are on the side of Ukraine and the United States and NATO. And therefore, this is a calculated sign of Israeli arrogance and a challenge to Russia, if you like.
And finally, since we did not see any reactions from Russia prior to the Ukraine conflict, when Syria was attacked repeatedly, and now we are seeing a reaction from Russia, does that mean that this is going to increase, given the fact that, at least based on the track record that Israel has had, it has attacked Syria repeatedly? Will we see more of a Russian response? And how far do you think this may go if this trend continues?
Well, Russia has a lot on its hands at the moment with the Ukraine situation. They're bound to give priority to that Ukraine conflict. Therefore, the Israelis will have to push the Russians a long way before Russia responds in any kind of military way. So far, the response has been diplomatic, has been the minimum that Russia could do. But the Israelis are playing a dangerous game. If they push and challenge Russia too far, then they may find that they wake up and there's been an Israeli military plane shot out of the skies. Russia is quite capable of doing this. But looking at the history of these attacks, so over 3 or 4 years, these attacks are by no means new. There have been literally hundreds of Israeli attacks, but by and large, the Russians have been signaling that Iran can basically look after itself. But when the Israelis attack Syrian targets, or targets which are close to Russian assets in Syria, then Russia will be forced to react. So we're entering a new and perhaps more dangerous phase of this game.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That is Peter Ford, former UK ambassador to Syria, talking to us from Manchester. Thank you, Peter Ford. The State Department says the Israeli military gunfire was likely responsible for the killing of veteran Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in May. The department, however, says that it has found no reason to believe that the shooting was intentional. It also claims that investigators could not reach a definitive conclusion regarding the origin of the bullet that killed the journalist. The department says the bullet was badly damaged and that prevented a clear conclusion. A member of the Palestine Liberation Organization has accused Washington of trying to protect Tel Aviv. On Saturday, the Palestinian Authority agreed to transfer the Americans the bullet that killed the Al Jazeera reporter for examination. However, one day later, an Israeli military spokesman said Israel would conduct the test under American observation. Abu Akleh was killed on May 11 while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin. Last month, UN Human Rights Office confirmed that it was Israel fire that killed her. Let's bring in Moti Abu Musaba, a political activist who joins us from Gaza City. So trying to understand this, you have the Americans, or the U.S., who provide military aid to Israel and have backed Israel, and it's probably one of their staunchest backers, conduct an investigation. That in itself is questionable. And then the result of the investigation that says it's inconclusive. It doesn't sound like that is a neutral party, to say the least, conducting this investigation, which is, in a sense, no surprise with the conclusion that it has reached.
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. Actually, it has become a matter of fact that this the result of this investigation presents another clue and blatant evidence on the blind support of the U.S. administration for the Israeli occupation, and gives the Israeli occupation the green light to commit more and more crimes against the Palestinian people. And we all realize that this was not the first crime Israel commits against the Palestinian journalist, and it would never be the last as long as the U.S. administration covers the Israeli occupation and backs the Israeli occupation forces. According to Al Jazeera report, more than 45 Palestinian journalists was killed by the Israeli occupation forces since 2000 so far. So this should mean that Israel tends to deliberately target the Palestinian journalist, and it's stemming from the constant policy that Israel uses against the Palestinian people and the Palestinian journalists precisely in order to cover its crimes. Israel tends to target the Palestinian journalists in order to hide its crimes and violations committed on a recurring matter against the Palestinian people, because Israel is always afraid of telling the truth. As this goes against the Israeli and the Zionist propaganda that promotes the Israeli occupation and the Israeli state as a democratic state and a vibrant democratic state in the Middle East. So we are in front of a new flagrant and blatant clue and evidence that the U.S. administration stands totally beside the Israeli occupation and gives the full immunity to the Israeli occupation to commit its crimes against the Palestinian people, which makes it as accomplice to those crimes committed against the Palestinian. I think if this crime was committed against any other Palestinian journalist, I think that the U.S. administration would have a different stance, especially amid the ongoing and the continuous crisis between Russia and Ukraine, as the U.S. administration claims it defends the human rights the human values and condemn the Russian violations of human rights. So what about the rights of the Palestinian people? What about the human rights of the Palestinian journalists? Today, according to the Israeli statement, that the Israeli army knows exactly where every bullet lands. So if the Israeli occupation forces know every bullet where it lands, so we are in front of a deliberate and complicated and a complete crime committed by the Israeli occupation forces.
Very well, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. From Gaza City, Moti Abu Musaba, political activist. Thank you. Moving on, shelling by Ukrainian forces has killed at least two people in the eastern Donetsk region, which is now the new epicenter of the war between Kiev and Moscow. According to pro-Russia forces, five civilians were killed and 13 others wounded in Ukrainian shelling of the region a day earlier. Local officials accused Russian forces of launching similar deadly attacks on civilians. The governor of Donetsk says seven civilians were killed and at least 20 others injured as a result of Russian shelling on Sunday. Russian forces captured the neighboring Luhansk region over the weekend, marking a significant milestone for Moscow. President Putin hailed what he described as the liberation of the region, ordering his forces to continue advancing towards the western parts of Donetsk. Ukrainian forces are boosting their defenses in the region. Pro-Russia forces in Ukraine controlled large parts of Luhansk and Donetsk, which formed Donbas before the war broke out. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, tells us about the latest developments in eastern Ukraine, just days after Russian forces fully captured the Luhansk region.
Well, here in Donetsk, there was about a week in which there was no Ukrainian bombing of this city. We expected that the reasons for that are Russian counterstrikes on the artillery positions just on the outskirts of the city. But a few days ago, shelling of Donetsk began again. As you like to say, there's been many casualties. Yesterday, a market was hit near the railway station. One person was confirmed killed there. And already this morning, I can hear some incoming in the city. So Ukraine, since the beginning of Russia's invasion, indeed, intermittently over the last 8 years, has been shelling civilians here in Donetsk, trying to terrorize the population effectively and trying to inhibit their support of the pro-Russian forces here. So unless Russia mounts some more counter-strikes against those artillery positions, we expect the killing of civilians here to go on for the coming days. It's also important to remember that NATO, of course, is arming now the Ukrainian army, who are intentionally shelling these civilians. Now, further north, of course, where we have the main fighting, the Russian army is advancing there. They've taken Lysychansk. We're not sure yet whether the Ukrainian forces will try and set up defensive positions in the town of Sversk, or whether they'll try to retreat further to the more defendable cities of Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. Meanwhile, Russia is carrying out major strikes around those towns in order to soften up defenses. But Russia is able to make large advances recently after taking Lysychansk.
Mexico's president says the Statue of Liberty would no longer be a symbol of freedom and should be dismantled if the U.S. gives a death sentence to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. López Obrador, who has offered asylum to Assange, says that he would call on the U.S. president to drop the charges against him. Obrador added that the Australian whistleblower has been treated unfairly and worse than a criminal. Assange is facing extradition from Britain to the U.S., where he is charged with publishing classified military and diplomatic documents. The WikiLeaks founder has appealed the British court ruling on his extradition. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran-Russia relations with Russian Ambassador to Iran, Levan Jagarian. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
Iran and Russia are entering into a new strategic era in their relationship. The West's sanctions and overreactions, and its failure to isolate Russia following the war in Ukraine, has resulted in a strategic reorientation of Russia towards the East and South, which includes Iran. Iran itself is taking full advantage of a new emerging multipolar world order and declining U.S. power, and is enhancing its strategic relations with emerging powers from around the world, from China in East Asia to Venezuela in South America. After all, Iranians witnessed the failure of the JCPOA process and the failure of the nearly 30-year attempt by certain Western-oriented Iranian elites to create rapprochement with the West, only to be embarrassingly rejected by the U.S. itself. Iran is confidently pursuing its national interests with its non-Western neighbors in Asia and friends and allies around the world, and closing the book on strategic rapprochement with the West. After a period of naivety and sophomoric false hopes about the West and America among Iranian and Russian elites in the 1990s and early 21st century, everyone in Iran and Russia has now witnessed the fundamental enmity of American and Western elites to the very existence of an independent and powerful Iran and Russia, which can effectively contain, roll back, and expel America from Eurasia as it tries to maintain its fast-fading claims to global hegemony. Iran and Russia have made a good start into this new strategic era. However, a number of issues remain to be resolved, particularly in the field of trade and economics. Once these issues are resolved and Iran and Russia sign the strategic agreement that is currently being finalized, Zbigniew Brzezinski's and America's nightmare scenario of the strategic alignment of Iran, Russia, and China will be complete, moving the world faster into the post-American era of contemporary human history.
Ambassador Jagarian, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As you know, our program is more of a conversation. Yeah. We want to get into the issues in a more deep fashion. We want to talk about it more from a historic, strategic perspective. And so with that in mind, there's a lot of things we need to cover in our conversation. I want to start with the thing that's unfortunately dominating the news, which is the special military operation in the Ukraine that was conducted and is still being conducted by the Russian Federation. We heard that at the beginning of this of the military operation, we had President Putin, we had Minister Lavrov, and various other officials talking about what would be the political end game of this operation. What is it that should happen politically for Russia to end the special military operation? So I would like to start a conversation with you, please explaining to us, telling us a little bit, giving us a little insight into what is it that is going to be required for this military, special military operation to end from the perspective of the Russian Federation.
First of all, thanks a lot for your questions. Thanks a lot for this beautiful opportunity to explain our position in this regard. Very good question. You know, for a long time, since the very beginning, and long ago, even since the end of the last year, we were talking about the necessity for the Ukraine to be a neutral country, mm-hmm. not to join NATO,
yes.
not to violate the balance of force in Europe, because we do believe that it was a plan initiated by Americans and their allies to create as Ukraine as a project anti-Russia,
yes.
to damage Russian interests, to damage yes. Russian security. That's why we were strongly against, let's say, full membership anyway, a membership of the Ukraine in NATO. Only be partiality. It was our main demand. But unfortunately, the European countries and the Americans, they just ignored Russian legitimate demands, expectations. Frankly speaking, you know, I do believe that this provocation, which was organized by Americans in the Ukraine, was a sort of attempt to deflect attention of the world from the defeat in Afghanistan.
Yes.
They were just in Afghanistan for more than 20 years, together with their European and not only allies, and they were defeated.
Correct.
It was a sort of disgraceful defeat of the United States of America and its allies in Afghanistan. I would like to repeat it once again. Disgraceful defeat of Americans in Afghanistan. And it would be very interesting to listen about the reasons of this defeat. But Americans will never tell you.
Yes.
That's why they decided to withdraw their troops from Afghanistan, and we were witnessing of this video when they were escaping Kabul airport like cowards. And they wanted to to finish their disgraceful operation in Afghanistan and to focus on the Ukraine, to create problems for us. You know that our demands of the military operation to Ukraine, special military operation, there are five well-known goals. Denazification,
yes.
Demilitarization, neutral status, recognition of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic as independent countries,
yes.
And to recognize Crimea, which historically belongs to Russia and was gifted during Soviet time as a gift, as a chocolate, to the Ukraine in 1954 as a part of the Russian Federation. It took place after a referendum, which was conducted in 2014.
Yes.
After illegal coup d'etat in the Ukraine, if you remember.
Yes.
It wasn't a democratic transition of power in the Ukraine. It was coup d'etat supported by the so-called Democrats in the West. So what we see now, unfortunately, the people are being killed, a lot of refugees, but it's not our choice. We were forced to do that to defend the interests of Russians who have been living from Donbass for centuries.
Yes.
And we will continue our special military operation till we reach our five goals. As to the negotiations, you know, initially Ukrainians were ready to negotiate. There were some rounds of negotiations, and this last one was in Istanbul, and we are very grateful for the Turkish government to create the possibility for such negotiations. But, you know, then, unfortunately, Ukrainians withdraw from their previous readiness to negotiate with us because the Ukrainian regime, they are independent.
They were under pressure.
Under pressure and under influence of the USA, not Brussels.
The Americans.
The Americans, of course. And they are waiting for instructions from Washington, what to do. So it's very difficult.
Mr. Ambassador, so the Europeans might have even been supportive of these talks, but it was the Americans that do not want the Ukraine to.
You know, Europeans are right now under total domination of the United States of America.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they have lost their own say. Right now, Europeans, they need such charismatic leaders like Jacques Chirac in France, Charles de Gaulle, Georges Pompidou.
Independent.
In Germany, Helmut Kohl, Willy Brandt.
Yes.
We don't have such charismatic leaders like
now. The level of leadership in Europe is very low.
Yes, unfortunately, unfortunately. We would like to see strong and independent Europe. We don't cast shadow on their, let's say, Euro-Atlantic solidarity relationship with the United States, the alliance, NATO, of course. But there are a lot of issues that they pragmatically must follow their own interests.
Exactly. And we see there's a lot of consequences now for a lot of the countries in Europe in terms of energy, in terms of prices, in terms of all the things that are, as a matter of reality, in fact, making them dependent or requiring them to have good relations with Russia.
Yes.
All these things are being disregarded.
Unfortunately. I would like to repeat once again, we would like to see strong united but independent Europe.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's a sort of humiliation.
It's embarrassing. And it's very interesting you mentioned this, Mr. Ambassador, because we have a very similar experience with that in Iran, which is they have interest in Iran, they've had interest in Iran for many decades, but they're not able to defend it in terms of, you know, economic and other things.
Yeah,
and we
yeah.
see that, like you said, there's no independent leadership in Europe. For whatever reason, this is also an interesting thing that
in
should
GCPOA,
be
in Greece. For example, in terms of GCPOA.
So, Mr. Ambassador, it's very good now that I want to now move to what I think is actually the most important issue that has come out of this crisis that we are experiencing, which is that this crisis has become a catalyst, an accelerator, an event, a historic event, which is transforming the global order.
Yes, yes.
There were indications of this happening before the crisis happened, before the special military operation began, in terms of how the world was moving, a certain level of decline that has occurred in America, maybe even a great level of decline, as you were talking about this sort of impotence by the Europeans, but also the rise of Eurasia, the rise of China, Iran, Russia, India, after a period of this so-called unipolar moment, or this era where the Americans were you know, commanding everyone and demanding whatever they wanted from everyone. I want to enter this issue, this idea of that there's a changing geopolitical order, maybe talk a little bit about Russia's future in this order, but I want to start this way. I've spoken to a lot of thinkers in Iran and also outside of Iran, but I haven't had a chance to talk about this from a Russian perspective, which is that we saw that in the beginning of the 21st century, 20 years ago approximately, maybe even at the late 1990s, the dominant view among many of the elites in Russia and in Iran was one that they had a positive view towards the West. And I would say maybe a little bit naive, maybe a little bit of a view where they didn't understand the essence of who they were dealing with. By what I mean by that, I mean that when you look at the behavior of the Americans, especially in the last 20 years, it is clear that for them it was never about coming to a mutually agreeable relationship, respectful. It was about diktat, about dictating things. And we see that particularly in the case of Russia and Iran, there seems to be a essential opposition to the existence of these two nations. And the reason, I would argue, is because from maybe the 19th century, the Westerners, whether it was the British or the Americans, knew that if Iran and Russia are strong, they would not be able to influence Europe, West Asia, that their hegemony in the area that they are assuming is dependent on these two countries not even existing. So, could we talk a little bit about, is it time that we learn the lesson from this history, both in Russia and in Iran, that maybe we made some mistakes in the early 20th century about our view about what the Americans are, the essence of how their relationship is with us? Of course, you're a diplomat. I'm not asking you to say something that's... I'm saying it as a researcher.
Lucky you are.
Yeah, thank you very much.
When I retire, I will speak like you. But right now, I should be a little bit more
exactly.
cautious. But anyway, about the existence of Russia and Iran, they would like to see us as a puppets.
Exactly.
Not as independent countries.
Exactly.
Because I think a main slogan of America is, if you don't agree with me, you are against me and I will punish you.
Exactly. This is what they've done in action.
That's why they don't have friends. When they say we have friends, allies, they are not neither friends nor allies. We understand it
exactly.
quite well.
Exactly.
In Russia, after the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, we have got a lot of freedoms in our country. A new page we opened in our bilateral relations with America, with Europe. No enmity anymore. And Cold War was over, and they thought that they won the Cold War, and they can dictate their will, their wish, their demands to others, especially to Russia. And at that time, we were very weak, of course.
Yes.
And very naive, let's mm-hmm. be frank. Me too. Mm-hmm. Me too, because I have started my diplomatic career in the foreign ministry of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
and I continue to till now. And we believe that we can open a new page in our relations with the United States and Europe. But we understood after 90s that it was a very wrong perception, mm-hmm. because their real intention was not to establish, let's say, normal, equal relations with the Russian Federation, with other countries, but only to establish their domination and to dictate their will to others, to impose their point of view.
Yes.
And right now, when I talk to some of my colleagues, I tell them that when I put parallels between socialist or communist era and your behavior right now in the European countries, I find a lot of similarities.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. So you're saying that the behavior of the Americans...
Americans and
not
European
very
allies.
Different from the time of the Soviet Union.
No, because it's similar. You know, I tell them, you are like communists right now. Uh-huh. I call them neo-communists, you know.
Right.
They don't want to listen to other opposite point of view.
Right.
It's opposite point of view is unacceptable for them.
Yes.
That's why they must combat with them. And you know that it is unacceptable. We are the only ones that have very right decision.
And the only ones that have interest. Nobody else has any interest.
That's why I call Europeans neo-communists. Not all of them, but those who support Americans. Because in Europe there are a lot of people, very wise, very pragmatic, who disagree with American domination, disagree with American policy, disagree with the policy of their governments. They are wise enough to defend their pragmatic interests.
Exactly.
I would tell only for that, for example, there is one government, one country in Europe who tries to defend their pragmatic interests because they do understand that, first of all, the priority of their government is the interests of their own people. The country is Hungary.
Yes, exactly.
I would like to use the possibility to say once again that the wise and pragmatic policy is very important for the Hungarian people. I do believe it's their domestic issue. I don't want to interfere, but it's my point own opinion. That's why it's very important, you know. They cut all contacts with us. Channels of communication and the level of ambassadors. How does it come? Very childish, let me be frank. I expected them to be more serious.
Well, on that note, I want to make a little humor with you. I would like to welcome you to the club that Iran has been in for the last 30 years. Now you are experiencing some of the things that we've been experiencing as it relates to sanctions and this childish, unreasonable behavior, because every country has its own interests. And this is something that everybody realizes. It's interesting. We have recently statements by none other than Henry Kissinger talking about the West should take Russia's interest into account. So, you know, Henry Kissinger is saying it, and nobody accuses Henry Kissinger of being a Russian spy or Russian.
Yes, sure.
We even have, just in continue what you were mentioning, we have a person which maybe a lot of people are not familiar with, but in within the Russian sphere, Dmitry Trenin, who is, you know, so-called liberal intelligentsia, a person which is famous for being pro-Western in Russia, part of the Carnegie Endowment after... you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, basically a symbol of what we're talking about, which is a group or a significant part of the intelligentsia being pro-Western. So this person now has come out and has written an article and has publicly stated that this reaction that we saw from the West to the special military operation by the Russians is so overblown, is so irrational, that... it's clear to him, somebody who is a flag bearer of Westernization or becoming close to the West, for him it's clear that this is now a war against Russia itself. So this is very interesting. We had similar experiences here in Iran with JCPOA, you know, for 30 years, people trying to get to some agreement, and we see we are all stuck. After 30 years, we're stuck. So with that, I think if we are able to learn, if the elites, if some of the decision makers are able to learn that lesson in Iran and Russia. Let's move now to how you see the future in terms of this changing global order. I will just mention a few headlines. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasian integration, using, you know, our national currencies for trade. How do you see this emerging new global order coming about? And where do you see Russia being in this new emerging global order in the future?
First of all, Russia has become a stronghold against American, let's say, Americans and their allies to establish their domination in the world. And now we are living in a very sensitive moment. Mm-hmm. I do believe that we will defeat Nazis in the Ukraine. They are Nazis. It is one of our goals. Unfortunately, many European countries, governments, support the Nazis in the Ukraine, even those who were just massacred during Second World War by Stepan Bandera, the close associate of Hitler.
Yes.
That's why it makes all of us surprised. As you mentioned, the liberals in Russia, of course, but they are in a minority, mm-hmm. and they have the right to have their own opinion.
Of course, but even they are realizing what the essence of this issue is.
And I would like to say, to underline, that the major part of Russian population fully supports the policy of my president, mm-hmm. because they do believe that only the victory, and I have no doubt that we will win. In this military operation, they will achieve our goals, and we support our president because he is defending our interests, the interests of the Russian population. As you mentioned, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasia, we have got very good lesson, and we tried to establish good normal relations with European countries, with the European Union before 2014. But we understood that, their real intention was to create problems for Russia, mm-hmm. because not only for Russia, for Iran, for China, for other independent countries. That's why we are witnessing the orientation of the Russian foreign policy, economic policy towards East,
yes.
and towards South,
yes.
and our friends. Who didn't join sanctions, who supported Russia, Chinese People's Republic, Iran, India, some other countries.
The majority of non-Western countries?
Yes.
There's a famous map that was, gone online. All the countries except for the Western countries didn't join the Global South, Latin America, Africa.
When some Western journalists are talking to Russian diplomats or Russian officials, they say international community disagrees, and we are asked a question, who are you to speak in behalf of the international community? You can speak in behalf of Western part of the Western countries, not the people. Not the people. Look what's going on in European countries, prices, inflation. And our message is don't blame Putin, don't blame Russia for your problems, blame your own governments, your mistakes. You have committed a lot of mistakes.
Mr. Ambassador, it's very interesting. I wanted to move on to that, but here you mentioned something which I think maybe we should go into a little bit more deeper. You mentioned Hungary. I don't want to abandon the West
yet,
but there's some things that I want to get your opinion on. So, yes, we see there's a reorientation. There is a learning process that has occurred for many countries, Russia, Iran, China, even India to a certain extent. We see that they are also understanding that this is not the same. And this issue of Eurasian integration is happening. As we say, inshallah, it will be a good thing soon for all of us. But I want to stay a little bit still because you mentioned Hungary. And we see, for example, the Baltic states. We see Finland. We see these countries that are on the border. And it seems to me that they don't really realize that they are throwing themselves into a situation where there's going to be a very hard border, maybe even something similar to the Iron Curtain, as was during the Soviet Union. And they're the ones that are going to suffer. It's not Russia that's going to suffer. Yeah. I mean, you can't really compare a small country. Again, I'm using the Baltic states as an example, who are basically dependent on so many ways on their relationship with Russia. You have very large Russian-speaking populations there. You have history, very long history with the neighboring countries, Poland, Slovakia, Moldavia, all those countries there. What would be your message to those decision makers, those elites, those people in those border areas? We even saw Finland and Sweden talking about joining NATO, although Finland has now stepped back a little bit today or yesterday.
No.
They said if Sweden doesn't join, we won't join either. So what would be your message to those countries? Is this really What would you say to them?
You know, as to Finland and Sweden, we had special relationship with Finland since the end of the Second World War.
Exactly. It was a neutral country during the Cold War.
So-called line, Paasikivi Kekkonen.
Yes.
And this policy of Finland neutrality, friendly relations with the former Soviet Union and then with the Russian Federation, created very calm atmosphere alongside a Russian-Finnish border.
Mr. Messer, excuse me, because some of our audience might not know. There's a very close, the border between Finland and Russia, St. Petersburg is right there, Helsinki is very close, it's very close to each other. This is not some distant.
And we highly appreciated the policy of bipartiality, neutrality of Finland, as well as of Sweden, though in military terms they from time to time cooperated with NATO forces. And unfortunately they decided to join NATO, but we don't pose any threat, neither to Finland nor to Sweden, but also to any other country.
Right.
Because, you know, one should be idiot to think that Russia is ready to invade any NATO country. Why?
Right.
Why? As to the three Baltic countries, you know, there are different pages in our bilateral history. Of course, they have their interpretation, we have our interpretation, but as you mentioned, three countries, in three of them we have Russian population, and in Latvia and Estonia they are deprived from their human rights.
Which is
citizens.
Excuse me, Mr. Master, because you mentioned this about the Ukraine. So in the Ukraine we have a major significant population that is Russian speaking.
Yes.
It was in the constitution that their cultural and language rights be protected.
Yes.
And after this coup d'etat and they changed the constitution and we see similar things happening in the
They both. Tried to ban Russian language in Latvia, in Estonia, in the Ukraine. And our question was to the British, if Ireland would ban English language, if Belgium would, ban French language, and they will say, we will speak only Flemish.
Exactly.
What would be their reaction? Of course, they would become very furious. What does it mean? It means, hypocrisy, which is so typical and not only for Americans. Double standards and hypocrisy. When we ask them a question, what happened in Ukraine in 2014? It was a democratic transition of the government of power or not? They keep silence.
It seems that with every passing day, we are getting closer to Zbigniew Brzezinski and America's nightmare of the strategic alignment of Russia, Iran, and China, due in part to America's own irrational and short-sighted policies and strategies. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و جورسپروденس
is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked...
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of...
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amali. Stay tuned. We humans must nurture ourselves in this perfect divine system of creation. Thus, we must be careful enough about how we are nurtured in this world. Our deeds and thoughts in this world are bridges to our destiny in the other world. In better words, we reap what we sow in the other world. All our routine daily deeds in this world are paths towards perfection in the other world. All our deeds, words, behaviors, and intentions are nurturing us in this world, which is like the womb of a mother. In other words, all our actions in this world are recorded, and one day the results of our good and evil deeds will be shown to us. We must be careful about our own actions. In the other worlds, every person is asked about his or her own deeds in this world. We are the guests of our own foods in the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by the late Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.